What's up, Open Floor Globe? This is Michael the Pod Pina from Sports Illustrated, and I know hearing my voice at the top of the show probably feels a little strange to everyone, but I'm super excited for this opportunity, following in the great Ben Golliver's footsteps as your host. Joining me for the very first time on the other line is one of my new co-hosts, someone I could not be more excited to talk about the NBA with, one of my all-time favorite writers, one of the nicest, smartest human beings in the sports media industry, which does not sound like a compliment, but it is. In our very first episode together, Chris Herring, Sports Illustrated senior writer, soon to be New York Times bestselling author. Welcome to Open Floor.
Dude, what? I'm sitting here like looking over my shoulder to figure out who the hell you're talking about. But thank you for all that. It's really my pleasure to join you. You know how I feel about your work and the ability to work with you. So I'm excited to be here with you, man. Thank you.
Yeah, this is great. So we have a lot to get to on today's show, obviously. You know, I want to react a little bit to the play-in games, preview the playoffs, a little bit all extremely exciting stuff. Let's begin with Wizards-Pacers, last night's play-in game, which was really terrible to watch, but at the same time, I feel like it was meaningful and that the Wizards advance and they will play the Sixers in the first round. So I just have a quick question for you off the top, Chris. You know, coming off that blowout win by Washington, would the Wizards have even made the playoffs if not for the play-in tournament? And I ask that because, you know, according to 538's projection system, on April 9th, their odds to qualify for the postseason were less than 1%. And wow. It's pretty wild. In a normal season, that means they'd probably head in the opposite direction and tank and lose intentionally, especially with a future first owed to the Houston Rockets for the Russell Westbrook trade. So just how much do you think the play-in's existence mattered here? And like, are the Wizards sort of the best case scenario embodiment for why the play-in even exists?
Well, you could certainly make that argument, and I don't think that someone would be able to put a, you know, a forceful argument the other way about it. What I do hesitate to say that, like, there's no chance, although obviously 538 would have disagreed with me on this. I mean, Scott Brooks, not that a coach gets say over the idea of tanking, but Scott Brooks, I think, pretty clearly obviously needed to win this year. Russell Westbrook is probably an incredibly difficult person to try to tank with. You know, I could imagine a couple of fan bases probably feel differently with regards to how he plays in the playoffs. But as far as, I mean, he's not going to not try, and players are not going to not try. Between he and Bradley Beal, I mean, those guys want to play pretty badly. I mean, obviously when there's something on the line, but they'd have to be completely out of it, make a coaching change, install an interim guy who you, I don't know what you would do, what say, look, we're going to bring you on for next year no matter what happens here. So don't feel the need to go out and kind of overextend guys to get wins that we don't need for the sake of what we're doing this year. So, Scott Brooks was not going to be that guy. So that's one thing to consider. The other is that this team, although they were not good, they were not great, certainly. They were really, really, really hamstrung and literally held out of the league for, 2 weeks because of the virus. They had almost half their roster sidelined because of the virus. They literally couldn't be together. I mean, I was rereading a story by Scott Cassiola, one of my old coworkers at the Wall Street Journal, about how, you know, they had people from the organization like delivering food and meals to people in hotels, at least in Davis Bertan's case. He was staying at a Residence Inn because he was trying not to infect his daughter, his newborn, and his wife. So, I mean, this was a pretty crazy story. You know, I don't know that it's certainly not a feel-good story from the standpoint of, you know, the virus was horrible and raging, clearly. But they, you know, they had six games postponed in the middle of January because of all this. And so, yeah, I mean, it was something with guys being healthy, with guys finally being on the same page, you know, maybe us getting out of kind of the throes of the virus generally that maybe helped them for a team that was impacted by it more than anybody. So they probably wouldn't have made the playoffs. There's no doubting that. But I don't think they would have just taken their foot off the pedal because they were so far out of the race. I mean, as long as there's a chance, and 538 might rule a team like that out way before Russell Westbrook himself would rule himself out. So I don't think that they would have given up necessarily. But, yeah, it absolutely presented another opportunity for them. And, you know, at a certain point, I'm sure Scott Brooks or someone else said to them, look, I mean, this is a weird season anyway. Being in 10th place does not kill you here. We've still got a shot. We've arguably got more star power than any other team that's going to end up at the bottom of the standings anyway. So let's go for this thing.
Right, the Russell Westbrook projection system has, I just checked it, the Wizards have a 100% chance of winning every game by 45 points.
105%.
Why not? No, I agree with everything that you just said, I think. And what I really love about the play-in, you know, there's a lot of things that I love about the play-in, but I don't know about you, but I just couldn't... I couldn't watch the Pacers or the banged up Hornets make the playoffs as an eight seed and probably automatically lose four straight games to the Sixers by like a total of 125 points or something like that. Like, I would not find that as interesting. So I'm very excited to see this Wizards team in the postseason and in the first round against a team that, you know, I feel like Philly is not as great, and we can get into this in a second. I feel like Philly is not as great as a typical one seed in a normal season, despite a lot of metrics that suggest they're awesome and they have two All-Stars and they have a coach who's won the championship and they have a proven general manager and one of the best players alive in Joel Embiid. But I kind of go into this, and I'm not crazy. I'm not picking the Wizards to win that series or anything like that. But when you look at the fact that they do have the Wizards I'm talking about now, they do have Bradley Beal, who, despite this hamstring injury, is still putting up numbers in his past two games since returning. They do have Russell Westbrook, who is healthy, who is this, you know, he's just a force of nature when he's as aggressive as he was last night. Can the Wizards do any damage in the first round, do you think, Chris? Or am I crazy?
I mean, there's an opening there for them to do it. I've hopped on a handful of Sixers Zoom calls this year to talk mm-hmm. with Doc and just kind of take stock of what's being asked. And I feel like, I don't know, you'd have to pull, you know, some Sixers writers to ask them, I guess. But I feel like no matter what question you ask, and I always joke with Zach Lowe about this, that no matter what question he asked me, I always find a way to bring it back to like my time on the Knicks beat at the Wall Street mm-hmm. Journal. And I feel like Doc is that way with the transition defense that the Sixers have, where like no matter what you ask him, it ends in a response about like, well, we're not that good on transition defense. Over quarantine, I watched The Sopranos, and Tony constantly gets angry with his Uncle June about bringing up the fact that he wasn't ever a varsity level athlete in high school. And it's that same feeling, like no matter what the context of what you're talking about is, Doc brings it back to that. So, you know, lo and behold, you know, the Wizards are, if not the best team, or, you know, at least the most, you know, plentiful team as far as how much they score. I think they're first or second in the league and, you know, fast break points, and, you know, the Sixers are second worst in that regard. And, you know, that's something that I'm sure is a concern. What Doc said and what his players have said, even, you know, since the regular season ended, is the idea that, you know, because they didn't know exactly who to be preparing for, they were just kind of practicing generally, but really hammering certain points. And guess what? You know, they're talking about transition defense the same way Doc was all season. So they were really hammering that home. So we'll see. I mean, I tend to think that if you rely really heavily on transition, that it, you know, that kind of goes by the wayside a little bit in the postseason, because it's the postseason. We've watched a number of teams, you know, over the last couple of years, the Bucks being one. I'm trying to think who's the other. Toronto, you know, at times kind of being another, that gets mm-hmm. a lot of transition in the regular season. But then when that's kind of grinds to a halt, that it's a little bit more difficult to score. So, you know, is there an opportunity that Philly, you know, is asleep a little bit here? Is there an opportunity that just the star power of the Wizards and kind of more traditional star power as opposed to kind of Ben Simmons prevails in a game or two or four? Yeah, there's absolutely a chance. Do I buy the odds of that being better than, you know, Russell Westbrook kind of reverting to playoff Russ? You know, like I can't bring myself to kind of say that I trust that and trust Russell Westbrook, given his history the last three, four postseasons, more than I trust the Sixers to find a way to win the series. Now, you know, it could be competitive. I could see them being, you know, 2-1 Sixers, you know, 2-2 or something like that going into game five. I wouldn't be shocked, but I would be shocked if the Sixers didn't find a way to win the series. Yeah.
I want to live in a universe where it is 2-2 going into game. I do not see that scenario necessarily.
I'd be surprised.
But yeah, that would be pretty incredible. You know, going back to something you said, if you want to make this a Sopranos pod going forward, Chris, like we can do that. Just so you know, I'm here. Huge fan, seen every episode like 15 times. I'm actually probably going to do a rewatch once the NBA season ends. So, you know, just hit me with any Sopranos references. Do not hesitate to drop them at your leisure. I also want to say, you know, I actually did not even put two and two together with the transition defense and them facing Russell Westbrook. So that's a great point by you. One of the reasons I'm so skeptical in general about Philly is their half-court offense, actually. And, you know, we could do a whole episode about Ben Simmons in the half-court and what they're going to do and who's going to be the play creator in crunch time and all that. But sure. I don't think that that's going to necessarily be a huge crutch against a team like Washington that has generally struggled on defense, I think is fair to say. And anyone who watched their play-in game against the Boston Celtics and just what Kemba and Tatum did to Davis Bertans that's just justified right there. But, you know, we're going to try to go back to, you know, playoff predictions in a second. But before we do, I want to just revert back to last night's game and talk for a second about the Pacers, which is a team that, you know, in listening to you appear on various podcasts over the years and reading your work over the years, I know the Pacers are near and dear to your heart for some reason.
I skew toward teams that generally play more defense, so I don't think this Pacers team is near and dear to my heart at all for that very reason. They're just so bad. And granted, they're... You know, if I'm going to talk about the Wizards having half their team out, I know I have to do that with the Pacers as well. But holy hell, like last night, and it wasn't just last night because the Wizards basically scored. I mean, the Wizards scored more points than that the last time they played them, I think. So last night was bad, but that's just kind of this is closer to what they've looked like for the last month and a half as far as how bad their defense has been. They just score a ton on offense. I mean, they have guys that are capable offensively, but. Yeah, I mean, I couldn't care less about the Pacers generally. I have a soft spot generally for teams that kind of will themselves to winning through defense and don't think it's a horrible way to build a team, you know, if you're just trying to figure something out, because you can steal a lot of games where you're not shooting well. But it's brutal to just sit there and watch them. And at certain points during the game, I was like, it felt like an all-star game on one end, as far as just the score and the lack of defense. And then I looked up, I was like, holy hell, are they going to give up more points than one of the teams did in the All-Star game? Like, I think Team Giannis gave up like 150 or something. So like for a minute, there was kind of a little bit of a close call. But like I said, they gave up more points than that at one point during the regular season. So it's just really, it's kind of like this bizarro world to of all teams to see the Pacers, who kind of like the Knicks, like almost every time you can kind of associate with the Knicks' history being positive and them doing something unexpected or really good or having a shot to be a contender, they've been really good historically on defense. The Pacers are like that too. And so it's just really bizarre to watch them be really horrendous on defense. And granted, like Pace is inflating some of that, but yeah, there's no soft spot this year for them other than TJ McConnell, who you know, bless his heart, is trying to vouch for Bjorkgren as best he can. And, you know, is a guy that would play hard for anybody, I'm sure. But, you know, aside from him and the plays he's making and the hustle that he's making defensively, holy hell. Holy hell.
TJ McConnell, a snub on the defensive player of the year, final three. Now, I'm kind of talking tongue in cheek there, but no, he's been great. I mean, the Pacers defense has kind of fallen off a little bit. I mean, they finished 14th in the league in defensive rating. They were basically the epitome of just average, I guess, when you look at it in the aggregate with their net rating, which was, I think, 0.1.
Yeah, I
0.1.
Remember.
Which is just, that's hilarious. And I think Nate Bjorkgren might have played his last, or coached his last game for that team. That's a possibility, given everything that's gone on there. They've had some injuries, too. But, you know, heading into this off season, if you're Indiana, coming off such a strange year, like if you were their GM, what would your plan of attack be? Would you just kind of keep everything the same and know that, hey, you have Brogdon, Caris LeVert, Sabonis, Miles Turner, all these guys are under contract next year, and three of them are under contract for the next two seasons. So, you know, developing that continuity is nice. Or not? Are you going to, you know, be a little bit more aggressive on the trade front and see what you can get for one of these guys? I could see both sides of the coin. Where do you kind of land on that?
I mean, I think you have to almost take one step further back. If you're the GM of the Pacers, are you able to keep your job? I think is actually like one question you have to consider here, because think about it. And this is a little bit meta and not completely fair, but the last two coaches that were there, man, you had Nate McMillan, mm-hmm. who quite frankly deserves some coach of the year votes. You know, I think you could very fairly argue him as at least third, you know, depending on how you feel about Quinn Snyder or Tibbs or Monty Williams. But, you know, basically took kind of where the Wizards were at almost, and not only got the Hawks in the playoffs, but did it kind of comfortably. You know, when you talk about midseason turnarounds, and I think third or fourth best record in the league since the All-Star break. So not only is that the guy you let walk or that you cut loose to bring in Nate Bjorkgren, but you brought in Nate Bjorkgren. And I mean, just when we talk about places that normally drama is not really a thing, I mean, Indiana has to be very near the top of that list in the last 10-15 years. But wow, I mean, you know, to the point where I think it kind of threw people off. And you know, so it, you have guys, and then, you know, not just that, but then the day that report came out, was it the day or was it the next day, then you've got Greg Foster, you know, shouting on the sidelines with Bataze, and it was a mess. It looked like a mess, and it's like I said, we're not used to seeing that. But you have a team where the reporters are openly asking the players whether they want to see him back, from Brogdon, you know, down mm-hmm. to other guys, and they're just not responding to that part of the question. And quite frankly, when you look at what Bjorkgren said yesterday, he didn't sound like someone that was either confident that he would be back, or he sounded like, I mean, it sounded more like something that you'd say after you were let go, like, I'm just proud of these guys and I'm always mm-hmm. going to care about these guys. It's like, that sounds a certain way. So I wouldn't be surprised if he's not back. But anytime you're having to let go of a coach one season in, I think you have to ask serious questions about whether the GM will be back, particularly when you're talking about the success that McMillan has had. And I think particularly when you're talking about the fact that before that, and granted, this was, I think, a different – I think this was when Larry Bird was still in charge potentially. But, mm-hmm. I mean, the other coach that was there right before that, you know, has since won a title. Now, granted, that's under completely different circumstances. But, wow, like, that's a pretty bad run of guys that you've let walk out of the building as an organization. And then all of a sudden you've got to let go of a guy 1 year in. And, you know – so it's just a weird kind of combination of things. I could see it going either way. I would be shocked if they bring Bjorkgren back. But there's a lot of talent there. And quite frankly, I think really at this point, everything needs to be on the table for the Pacers. in the same way that I think it was for, you know, for Houston. Last year, it was very clear that Houston was going to have to do something. We figured that D'Antoni was going to walk. He did, you know. And at that point, I remember writing a column saying, like, I think Harden has to at least be on the table and see what you can get for him kind of at the peak of his powers before he starts to get older. And, you know, they did that. And I remember I was like a little bit too chicken to say, like, I mean, and at a certain point, like, what more can Morey really do too? Like, maybe it's time for him to move on. And I was too chicken to write it, or, you know, to kind of write a whole column just about him. But that ended up happening too. And so, I mean, this is a situation where I think at literally everything from like top of the organization, we're talking about Pritchard, down to like, you know, obviously Sabonis, I think needs to be considered just moving him to see what you can get for him. I know everybody was out. A bunch of people were out yesterday, but like it building a defense around him seems like a task. And I don't know if it's just building a defense. I don't know if it's scheme, because they looked a mess from that standpoint too, of constantly going over screens on Russell Westbrook, which is just going to get you burned to a crisp every time, because there's no reason to ever do that. And I mean, so the fact that they just got bludgeoned each time they played the Wizards, even though like they weren't correcting really simple sorts of fixes, like Caitlin Cooper from Indy Cornrows, who I think is one of the best writers bar none, you know, in the country, particularly on one team and on that team. She had literally a list of do's and don'ts in a column that she wrote before the play-in game. And they didn't do every do, and they did every don't. And I mean, it was just kind of mind boggling to watch it, because, you know, people were tweeting at me yesterday complaining about their offense. And granted, like every single play after a while was going through Sabonis, but it's like, how are you complaining about their offense with what they're doing on defense? At least they're scoring. At least they're going to have 80 through three quarters, but they're going to give up like 120 through three quarters. And that's just not acceptable. So I get Miles Turner wasn't there. You have some really nice pieces. You could get some nice things back in return for some of these guys. So absolutely they need to make some moves. I feel like they don't have quite enough two-way players on their team. They have a couple, obviously, and but they've got a lot of guys that are really, really great on one end and then not so great on the other. And so like a guy like McDermott is going to be interesting to see like what they do with him. They've got McConnell, who's going to be a free agent, and it'll be interesting to see what they do with him, because all of a sudden they'd be a team that is like close to the tax, I think, which is nuts considering just the way they looked. But they do have a lot of guys that were out, Turner and obviously Warren, and obviously LeVert is another big one. So who knows? There's a weird team that exists right now in the league, just kind of with what they have on the table. What do you think about where they're at?
Well, I think that the Pacers should hire Caitlin Cooper to be their head coach.
Me too.
That's long overdue. Shout out to her. You know, you kind of took the words right out of my mouth talking about Sabonis. I think that that situation is very fascinating. He's, I think, only 24 or 25 years old. He's on a really good contract through 2024. Two-time All-Star. He's incredible offensively. He's very similar to he plays very similarly to how the Miami Heat use Bam Adebayo. Obviously, defense is a different question, and Sabonis is a better shooter with more well-rounded post moves, I think. Usually you don't trade players like that, but I'm with you. Like, I wrote this column about Brad Beal earlier this week, and at the end I posited, hey, if you're the Wizards and you're trying to get better and win now and show Brad Beal that you're serious about winning now, like, Sabonis feels like the best player who's conceivably attainable. I don't know if the Pacers would agree with that, or whoever is running the team would agree with that. I think that, you know, building around someone like Sabonis is very attractive. But, you know, if you could get Rui Hachimura or Denny Avdia and a bunch of draft picks and Davis Bertans, like, there's still a lot of talent there to win now and rebuild on the fly. So I think it's fascinating. We spent way too much time talking about the Pacers. I apologize.
That's my fault. I sat here and talked.
No. But, you know, going to, keeping with the play-in, but kind of going to a more, I think, exciting, relevant element of it, you know, I want to talk to you a little bit about the Los Angeles Lakers. as title contenders still coming off of their 3-point victory over the over the Golden State Warriors the other night. You know, do you feel heading into this first round series now that they have against the Phoenix Suns and the road that they have to potentially get back to the finals, do you feel more or less confident in the Lakers as title contenders after watching that game on Wednesday night?
I actually feel about the same. And if anything, like, I'm not more concerned, but seeing, I mean, Curry is such a unique, singular talent to where I don't think you can take a whole lot from that experience and extrapolate it. But that said, though, I mean, you've got part of what was concerning, I think, for a lot of folks that were looking at the film before the matchup. I remember watching Anthony Slater post a tweet about, you know, how far back Drummond was going to play Curry, just looking at past experiences of when he played Curry defensively and just how lost he looked. And you saw a lot of that in the game the other night. I do wonder a little bit about kind of, I just think what makes Phoenix so interesting to me and compelling, and I think in particular, like, all I'll be watching if they're fortunate enough to get to the conference finals and they get a matchup against a Utah. Chris Paul and Devin Booker are just going to pull up for mid-range shots all day long if you give them those shots, particularly if you're like a Rudy Gobert and you're Utah and you want to give them those shots. You don't want to give them those shots, but you're used to doing that against everybody else. So I'm really interested to see the way the Lakers handle guarding a team that has multiple weapons. I mean, Chris Paul, it's weird to think of him as a weapon because he's not always really looking to score necessarily, but there's him and there's Booker and there's Ayton. And then, oh, by the way, you've got to guard these guys along the perimeter, depending on who's playing alongside them, whether it's Bridges or Crowder or whoever else. Maybe that's easier for the Lakers than having to guard Curry. I'm not sure, but I certainly didn't walk away with any more confidence because of their win over the Warriors. I mean, it took everything they had to win that game. And quite frankly, you know, I thought Jared Dudley's comment the other day was interesting where, you know, the idea of teams positioning themselves to kind of avoid the Lakers if that's what they were actually doing, which it kind of seemed like it was. You know, Jared Dudley being pretty blunt and honest and saying, like, the earlier you get us, probably the better because we haven't really played together that much. And I'm so fascinated by the idea of cohesion versus, like, a lack of cohesion. The fact that the Suns have played their guys together now, what, 200 more minutes? Their most used five-man lineup, which is the most used five-man lineup in the entire league, that their guys have been together for more than 200 minutes longer than the next closest five-man lineup in the league, let alone whatever the Lakers' most used five-man lineup is and how little they've played in the last couple months, just given what we've seen. So, I mean, it's going to be a total contrast in a couple of ways, I think. And I don't feel great about the Lakers. I haven't made a pick yet in terms of what I see happening. And I think we have to turn them in later this afternoon for SI, our picks. But I left that one blank, and I left the Knicks-Hawks series blank because I could see it going either way. Like, I don't have a lack of faith in the Suns because they haven't been here before, because they've got actually a decent number of veterans on the team. I think people always tend to downplay these teams that that have never been to the playoffs before, that core has never been to the playoffs together as a core. Happened with the Bucks a few years ago. Well, I guess they'd been to the playoffs before, but they'd never won in the playoffs. Happened with them a few years ago when they had that, you know, almost 70 win season. It happened with it happens with everybody, where we always do this, where people weren't trusting of the Warriors when they started that kind of dynastic run. It always happens where we have this question, and it doesn't happen until it happens, and you're like, oh, wow, they are good. And so if the Suns were to – it's weird. I feel like a lot of people are going to pick the Suns to lose a series, but if they somehow win this series, then they're going to become everybody's favorite because they took out the big bad wolf sort of thing. So I could see it going seven very easily. I don't see the Lakers winning that series easily. Could be completely wrong. You know, it's LeBron, it's Anthony Davis, but – there's nothing about that worries me. I don't think it made me less confident in them, but there's nothing about that made me more confident at all.
I forget honestly what I put for my prediction for this series. No, I you know, I picked the Lakers. I know I picked the Lakers, but I want to say it was 6, could have been 7, and honestly, I'm waffling. Just like after watching the Warriors game, like I'm not super high on the Lakers, and I haven't been super high on them for a while now. So it's hard for me to be less confident, but it's just like, you know, the way this team is constructed is so awkward to me. And, you know, they have to play Anthony Davis at the 5 a lot. And we saw, I know the play-in game was very unique because the Warriors play Draymond at the 5 and they're small and all that. And you have to be versatile because of Curry and all of his off-ball movement. But, like, Andre Drummond played, I think, 16 minutes. Montrezl Harrell played under 10 minutes. Marc Gasol did not play at all. And it's like, those three occupy roster spots. And so to invest in the center position when your best lineup is so clearly AD at the 5, LeBron at the 4, and then whatever else, like, it's just so strange to me. I don't think that LeBron, you know, I hate ever doubting LeBron, but he's 36 now. He's got this ankle injury, and he didn't look like himself at all in the first half of that game. And like, I just don't know if he can drag a lot of these supporting pieces that were not there last year in the bubble when they won the title. I mean, this team is it's constituted so differently than that championship squad. I think that they will miss Rondo. I think that they will miss Dwight, frankly. So I don't know. Like, I struggle to reconcile just generally, like, what matters. And, like, does everything that happened in this regular season count because of just how strange it was and the physical grind and a lot of the data that we use to predict things for the postseason, I feel honestly can be thrown out the window because you really have to take into account who played when you played a certain team. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's just like, it's really difficult to, like, I'm looking at the Lakers, all their numbers, and a lot of it is like meaningless because they're starting 5 has played 46 minutes. Like, that's just, it's not gonna, I don't know, like, is LeBron and AD enough to kind of overtake that? Like, I don't know. And so I wouldn't be shocked, honestly, if they lost in the first round. I wouldn't be shocked if they got to the finals. I don't know what to make of this team, to be honest with you. I don't really know what else to say about the Lakers. I'm very excited to watch this series. This first round series is one of the more intriguing ones for me for a lot of different reasons, and I can't wait to see how often Frank Vogel goes small. I was frankly surprised that Andre Drummond started the second half of that play-in game.
Me too.
Yeah, so it's very weird. You know, we'll see what happens with them. Switching gears a little bit, Chris, I want to talk to you about, you know, the play-in teams that, you know, on this subject, like the play-in teams that can actually win a playoff series. We already talked about the Wizards. We just talked about the Lakers. Is there anyone else that you think could actually win a series? And the teams here that I'm obviously referencing are my beloved Boston Celtics, soon to be RIP, the winner of tonight's Warriors-Grizzlies game. I guess that's it. So just like, do you foresee any possibility with those teams actually having a shot in the playoffs?
I mean, so similar to what you said about LeBron, look, you know, if the Warriors end up playing the Jazz, the Warriors have the best player in that series. And so is there a chance? Yeah, there's absolutely a chance. You know, he would really fundamentally put strain on what the Jazz generally do really well, which is defend and force.
You're talking about you're talking about Jordan Poole, right?
Man, that dunk he almost threw down the other night. Holy hell. He would obviously put real strain on them and give them more to think about. Look, I'm as big a fan of Memphis as they come, really, and just watching them play and Ja, and, you know, I know that they've gone a lot of the season without Jaren Jackson, really young team. The more I've watched them this year, and the more I've watched them lose games down the stretch, I was writing a big story about them the day after they lost that really brutal buzzer beater against Luka some weeks back, maybe 4 weeks back, 5 weeks back, whatever it was. I've watched them lose so many games down the stretch, and so many games where, quite frankly, like Steph Curry just obliterates them because they don't really seem to have the defensive IQ yet as a young team of kind of what to do when things break down or where to go and how to scramble defensively. I watched in a game where I think Jokic should put up 40 plus, whatever it was, that they're still leaving him like wide open on screen rolls or pick pop stuff. And it's just like young mistakes that you don't expect people to make unless maybe Drummond is out there and he's not really sure where to be. So I can't really see them beating Golden State unless maybe Steph is hurt or something weird happens. Even if Steph were to shoot poorly, I still think Golden State would win because Steph could, you know, Steph can make use of his gravity and hit guys, or other guys can hit shots. If Wiggins can have a good game or something like that. I would be stunned if the Grizzlies win this game on the road in a play-in. And even if they do, you know, I think the Jazz would just be licking their chops and probably, you know, looking skyward to thank God that, you know, that they got the Grizzlies instead of having to play the Warriors. So that's my thought on that. The other matchup with Brooklyn and Boston, look, I mean, Tatum could go nuts and go supernova, but I don't like anybody's chances if you're relying on one or two guys to try to do that against the two or three guys that Brooklyn will have. And I say two or three because obviously Brooklyn is prone to have injuries and have weird stuff come up. But I really just don't see how we find ourselves in a situation where Boston's going to win that. Even with the lack of cohesion, Brooklyn's been pretty dominant. And I just think even if Brooklyn's defense is trash, they can outscore Boston without Jaylen Brown is my thought. So I don't see that one being quite as competitive. I think maybe Boston can take a game or two, you know, if something weird happens or, you know, Brooklyn's just really off. But so I do think Curry could make it interesting. I would be a little bit surprised, borderline stunned, if the Warriors won that series. People kept talking about, oh, man, Lakers, Warriors, like whoever comes out of that might be favored for their series. I can understand why people were saying that about the Lakers. I don't get that with the Warriors, like not without Clay and not without, you know, a little bit more, you know, a little bit more of what we've been used to seeing out of the Warriors. I think there's a fundamental difference between the Lakers and the Warriors and exactly how much fear they put in someone's heart. I think Steph puts fear in people's hearts, but I don't, like, that's not a championship roster the way it's been in the past with Golden State. So I would still take the Jazz here. You know, other than the Lakers, I think the Wizards can potentially make it interesting, and I think the Warriors can make it interesting, but I don't see any of the play-in teams winning their series other than maybe the Lakers.
Yeah, you know, I texted this to someone the other day, but if the Celtics manage to win two games against the Nets, it'll basically be like, I will react like they won the NBA Finals. Let's just put it that way. I have extremely low expectations for them in that series. I think that Tatum will get triple teamed on every touch. He'll get triple teamed coming off every screen. You know, they love to throw him at the elbow and let him kind of dictate. I don't think, like, anyone who watched the Lakers play the Rockets last year in the bubble and how the Lakers treated James Harden, I anticipate the Brooklyn Nets doing that to Jason Tatum anytime he starts to get hot at all. And Tatum isn't even close to the, yeah, exactly. And Tatum isn't even close to the playmaker that Harden is. So I that's going to be really tough for Boston. Like, they're going to need Evan Fournier to look like someone who's about to earn a max contract to have even the slightest chance. And that's just, I mean, I'm getting depressed talking about it. But I generally agree with everything else you said about all the other play-in participants and kind of their chance to make a dent. I mean, the Lakers, I did pick them to beat the Suns, and for obvious reasons. I would love to see the Wizards show up. I would love to see, I mean, I feel like we are discounting, or maybe I am discounting, the Grizzlies a little bit, and you just, you know, waxed eloquently about just how they perform in various ways. You know, Dylan Brooks, it's like his defense against Steph. His defense generally is just very, it's good when it's within the rules of the game, but like he fouls out in that regular season game, right. The last regular season against the Warriors, and they just fall apart after that. But then in the play-in against the Spurs, his defense against DeMar DeRozan is otherworldly, like prime Ron Artest. So I'm really interested to see just like how the whistles impact his ability to
influence
the game.
Yeah. Because they do get really, I mean, it's, and you tend to see this with young teams and sometimes with just teams with a single star where that one guy is out and then the wheels just come off. And it's interesting because I think offensively Ja's that guy for them for pretty obvious reasons. They don't have a whole lot of creators on that team, but defensively he ends up being that guy because you just don't have, I mean, and really like that's something that you always hope kind of fades with more experience is the foul trouble stuff. But yeah, he's been fantastic. He can make it interesting. I just would be really surprised if they win because of it, particularly at home, or I'm sorry, on the road tonight. And then, like I said, even if they do get it, it would be a huge step for them. You know, would garner them a ton of respect, I think, to beat Steph on that stage in a must-win game. But I really do feel like the Jazz would just kind of be licking their chops if they get them in the next round. You could always take an individual game against somebody, even though obviously I'm not giving them a huge chance to do that. But, you know, the series, it would be great to see them get there. But it's hard to imagine them really worrying the Jazz all that much. I think, you know, the Jazz, they wouldn't tell you, but they might whisper to you that, you know, they would rather have the Grizzlies any day as opposed to Steph. You know, yes, they would probably rather play the Grizzlies 5-on-5 than play Steph 5-on-1.
That's a very fair point. And any team that beats Steph Curry, any team that beats Jordan Poole, just hang something in the rafters for them. So, you know, Chris, broadening it out a little bit, which playoff series are you just most looking forward to overall? Because a few of them basically all of them actually have been set for a few days now. And there's a lot of exciting matchups. So which one are you just kind of licking your chops at and you can't wait to start?
So we talked obviously about Lakers Suns, you know, that one likely involving a title contender, or at least the, you know, even if not the defending champs from last year. So I think that kind of goes without saying. Aside from that though, Hawks Knicks to me is so evenly matched. Like it's like I said, I've got two series that I haven't been able to pick yet in terms of length or even winner. And I normally it's more a question of like who's, you know, how many games. I couldn't tell you who I thought was going to win that series just because, you know, regardless of how you feel, I think, you know, you could probably pretty easily say that Randall will either likely end up on an NBA team or he'll end up being the guy that got the most votes that ends up being, you know, left off or something mm-hmm. like that. So whether you think he's better than Trae Young or not, you know, for the sake of this season and the way that, you know, that award will be voted out, Randall, you could say, is the best player in the series. Then you've got Trae Young. And then after that, you know, you've probably got two, you could argue maybe even three players from the Hawks that are better than anybody the Knicks have. You could at least make the argument. So you've got Trae. I think you have to have Capella right there in that conversation afterwards. And then you've got John Collins and you've got Bogdanovich. And then, you know, maybe somewhere in that same range, you've got RJ Barrett and some of the other Knicks guys after that. But, I mean, you've also got DeAndre Hunter. And you've got, like, it's weird.
I love the Hawks.
I mean, I do, too. And it's weird because you've got so much talent over there. And, you know, Knicks fans would jump out of their seats to tell you that they swept the season series 3-0. You know, and they've certainly had guys missed time. Rose was out for a long stretch with COVID, and other guys have been out. And hell, Mitch Robinson's been out the whole year, pretty much. He's not going to be back for the series. But, you know, so I know they've had their injuries too, but, like, the Hawks were real, 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 real banged up to where, I mean, a coach kind of got fired over it in part, you know. So, it's just a team that really we're just now kind of seeing them at full strength, somewhat full strength. And the guys are just clicking. And for me, it's not, I mean, the Knicks have obviously shown they can score. That was kind of a big part of their hot streak, you know, toward the end of the season. But for the Hawks, like, they've got a bunch of guys, at least two, three guys that can all kind of create their own offense aside from Trey, that, you know, even when Trey's on the bench, which I think that's the big question here, because even if you look at the regular season, you know, I think that the Hawks outscored the Knicks when Trey was on the court. But I want to say some of those games where they're playing, like, some of their other guys, and I think Bogdanovich in particular, I think he missed right. at least one of those games too. So, and the last time they played, which was at March, maybe April, whenever it was, the Hawks were winning, I don't know what you'd want to say is comfortable. They were up by like 8 or 10 points when Trey went down with an ankle injury and had to be helped off the court at the Garden. So the Hawks are right there. I mean, the games are competitive each time. Yes, the Knicks won all three of them, but the Hawks are pretty close to full strength now. They've been playing just as well as the Knicks have. And I just kind of feel like they've got more weapons than the Knicks do in a series, not to mention that they've got guys that they've kind of been through some of this a little bit more than some of the Knicks players have, at least recently. So I don't know. I don't know what to predict. I'm also really intrigued by just how big these crowds are going to be. I've obviously been doing a lot of reporting around the Hawks anyway for the last week to write a big piece on kind of how long the Hawks have been waiting on this moment, specifically with a star, like a superstar-ish sort of player, which it's a little premature to say that about Trey, but they've gone 28 years without having a guy rank in the top 10 of the MVP vote. And, mm-hmm. you know, and because of that, they've really struggled to draw an audience and to draw people to the arena. And not only are they getting people kind of back in the fold as fans, but, you know, it's Georgia, and so they've kind of had looser restrictions with regards to Georgia for a while with the virus. They've had bigger crowds than most teams, and now they're upping their capacity for the playoffs. And the Knicks are, you know, it's almost kind of like a duel here where the Knicks, I think, opened their capacity up to like 15,000 for, you know, for their home crowd out of like 19,000. So it's almost, I mean, it's going to be like a really full crowd, and it's like more than double, I want to say, what they've been allowed to have since, you know, over the last few weeks. So it's going to be, I mean, these are two fan bases that have waited a while, particularly the Knicks. And you can tell that they're, you know, not to say that they're not following guidelines or anything, because I'm sure they are. But, I mean, this is very targeted to try to get, you know, as much of a home court advantage as they can to really milk this for everything they can. And they should. And I don't know how the Hawks will react to that with a bunch of first-timers, with Trey being in the playoffs for the first time. But it's all really fascinating, and it seems so evenly matched. Maybe the Knicks have the better player, but the Hawks have kind of a deeper rotation of guys that can get this done. The Knicks are dealing with a guy that a lot of fans don't even want in their starting lineup, don't want in the rotation at all. And the little things around the margins will matter here. And it'll be interesting to see how long Thibodeau keeps Elfrid Payton out there if he's not productive or if he's not playing well.
Yeah, first of all, everyone go check out Chris's wonderful story on SI.com. That was one of my favorite pieces written in a very long time.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I'm kind of shocked that so many people are picking the Knicks in this series. And maybe that's just like, I mean, it is anecdotal, just me kind of perusing the internet. I mean, I picked the Hawks, I think in 6, maybe in 5, if I was feeling bold at the moment.
Wow.
I can't recall. Yeah,
wow.
I mean, Atlanta's offense is, first of all, Atlanta is comfortable playing at the pace that the Knicks want to play at, and not a lot of teams want to play at that pace, so I feel like that could shock certain matchups. The Hawks are very comfortable doing that since Nate McMillan took over on March 1st. And, you know, since the All-Star break, their offense with Trae Young is averaging like 1.21 points per possession, which is just an absolutely absurd
Jeez.
Number. And, yeah, and... like, I don't know. I'm just totally in the tank for guys like DeAndre Hunter and Kevin Huerter. And, you know, I wrote a piece near the beginning of the season on Clint Capella and why he should be getting all defensive team buzz. And he's just been a total, total monster. I love, now that I'm thinking about it, I also wrote about John Collins. Yeah, I guess, like, I'm clearly, there's some bias in me here. I adore the Hawks. We did not even mention Lou Williams. We did not mention Gallinari. Right. There's so many names on this team, so many fascinating pieces. I don't want to take anything away from the Knicks, even though I think I just did. I feel like Tibbs is the coach of the year for me, in just how he took so many. I mean, a lot of those guys were on the team last year. And to see how they played this season, I mean, RJ Barrett's off-ball defense last year was so, so bad. And this year he's like above average. Like, how does that even happen? Like, it's one of those things where you look at coaching. That's really, it's really hard to kind of measure coaching and what's good coaching, what's bad coaching. That's good coaching. Like, Tom Thibodeau has a track record of improving defenses. He did that here. They have an identity because of him. So I don't want to, again, take anything away, but I just feel like the Hawks have so much talent, man.
There's like two questions, too, that I think are really relevant here. Mm-hmm. Tom Thibodeau, obviously, I mean, we've known for a while the guy can coach. There's never been a question about that. I think the hesitation of him hopping back in the league or teams hiring him or what have you, I think was kind of more rooted in, you know, is the league starting to kind of step outside of some of the defensive stuff that he became known for with Chicago and Minnesota and stuff like that. So I think there was that. And also, you know, the way of thinking, the minutes, the grind that he puts on his top players, the grinder that he puts his top players in. And, you know, look, if there were any franchise in the league that would have said, hey, man, if you want to play guys 52 minutes a game instead of 42, if it gets us in the playoffs, we're all for it. Like, I think the Knicks would have been that team. So I think it was a pretty irrelevant question during the season, but it will be fascinating to see if the Knicks already kind of maxed out. You know, granted, they've had a nice little break here, which should help them and, you know, a little bit, you would hope, if they were feeling worn down or what have you. But they look pretty good at the end of the season. So I'm curious to see that part of it. I'm also really curious, as we were talking about the improvements that, you know, that we saw from RJ and everybody else, they obviously have improved defensively, collectively, individually, what have you. John Schumann from NBA.com tweeted this fascinating stat, which I guess I hadn't picked up on before he tweeted it, which is why I wanted to call it out, where, what was it? It was something like four or five of the biggest jumps that we've seen this year in like volume three-point shooters, guys that have taken more than 100 this year and took more than 100 last year, like four of the eight or five of the eight throughout the entire league, the biggest jumps in percentage have been Knick players. And it was like Randall and RJ and Rose, and I think Bullock might have been another. And it's like, that's really crazy. Like, if we were talking about baseball, it's one of those things where you would be like, are all these guys juicing? Did they, you know, or did they all sign? Did they all sign with Colorado during the offseason and, you know, play with the thin air? It's really rare to see that many guys make that pronounced of a jump. And so while I don't think that everybody will just fall back to earth now all of a sudden, you know, we might only be talking about a 5-6 game series, depending on what happens. So it's not like, you know, we're going to see a hardcore regression to the mean after 72 games. But it'll be interesting to see whether they can kind of keep that up and whether everybody keeps that up. My fear for them for a while has been like, obviously Randall's improved, but if the jumper doesn't fall for him, does he force stuff in a series? Does he kind of get frustrated and force it? Does he make the right play when teams kind of collapse on him and find Bullock in the corner? Obviously, his teammates have given him enough reason to trust them, given how well they've shot. But, yeah, in the playoffs, you don't really get a whole lot of do-overs. And I've watched a Knick team before fall down in a series 1-0 and overreact because of it. So, you know, in a series where they had home court advantage. So I'm just very curious to see what happens. You could tell me anything would happen. You said, hell, maybe Atlanta in five. That would stun me if either team wins the series in five, because I just find this one to be – so evenly matched, but there's a whole lot of stuff that that I'm curious to see how it's played and how it's handled and how players like Randall and Trae Young and the other guys react to what's going to be done to them defensively, because it's going to be a fun series. It should be a fun series, if for no other reason than the crowds. But I also just think that it's really, really evenly matched.
Yeah, I agree with all of that, especially like what's fascinating to me when I look at teams going from the regular season to the postseason is what their approach was during the regular season with regards to their rotations and just how serious, like how many minutes, what percentage of total minutes did the starters play versus the bench versus, you know, staggering stars. And the Knicks just, you know, they went basically all in on the starting five as much as almost any other team. I think Philly might lead the league in that category. I haven't checked in a little while, which is another reason why I'm a little down on the Sixers relative to the competition, just because in the playoffs, you know, the stars, the starters, they play more minutes. So if you spent the entire regular season playing your starters a ton, like where do you go from here? And I feel like I adore the season that Randle has had, and I respect the hell out of him for suddenly becoming an accurate 3-point shooter, which is something I never ever thought was possible. But his like mid-range shooting isn't that great, particularly on the pull-ups, which he takes a decent amount of. And you know, he's assisting corner threes more than just about anybody, and his playmaking is it must be respected. But I don't know. Like, if you know, you said that Randle is the best player in the series, and I don't necessarily disagree, but he's not the like the margin between him and anyone else on the Hawks just isn't wide enough for me to think that that is some kind of distinct advantage, if that makes any sense.
Especially if even if you're saying Trey is two,
Yeah.
at least two, three, and four, I think, have to be on the other side of the, you know, on the other sideline. And that's just where I always am fascinated, where, you know, Giannis several years ago playing against Boston, it kind of had that feel to it. You know, obviously Middleton is somewhere in that conversation, but, you know, where you were looking at it and you were like, okay, well, depending on how you look at this, you've got enough other guys on Boston's roster where you feel good enough to say, even if they don't have the best player on the roster, they've got enough of the guys right behind that to where you feel really good. And that's where I worry a little bit about the Knicks is, you know, this is RJ's first time on the stage. The Hawks have a couple guys where, you know, they haven't had this opportunity either with their young core guys, with Collins and Herter and what have you. But we'll see. I don't, like I said, you could tell me just about anything and I could probably be talked into at least seeing it play out that way. But yeah, I'm more than a little bit thrown off by how many people are picking the Knicks with like no hesitation, because I, even if it was a 3-0 season series, you know, the Hawks are a completely different team now than they were, you know, when they weren't healthy. Completely different team just in terms of who they're coached by. Completely different in the sense that Trae Young, you're not expecting him to get hurt and leave midway through the series the way he left midway through the game, or, you know, three quarters into the game the other time when they had the lead, and then just watch the whole thing fizzle as soon as he left. So it's going to be really interesting. You know, I don't know how many people have watched the Hawks as much as we have, but they're extremely fun to watch, and they are, you know, a handful to try to defend. And you know, the Knicks are great defensively, but it'll be a challenge for them as well defensively.
Yeah, you know, I texted you before we recorded this episode that, you know, if you want to make this a Hawks, all Hawks podcast, I'm here for it, man. And it is wild that one of these two teams is going to make the second round. Like, I don't think anyone predicted that heading into this season, and here we are. Before we go, Chris, I just want to wrap up real quick talking about, you know, the regular season award finalists dropped yesterday. MVP, Sixth Man of the Year, Most Improved Player. And I just wanted to kind of get your take on the categories. Were there any surprises for you? Was anyone snubbed? Did someone that you wish cracked the top three didn't and you wanted to shout them out? Just what were your reactions to them?
Yeah, I mean, nothing where I'm, you know, gonna bang my fist on the table about it, but there were a couple. So I mentioned it earlier. I think Nate McMillan, he wouldn't be like a traditional candidate for Coach of the Year because he didn't coach the whole year. But to me, that speaks volumes about the fact that he didn't even need the whole year to do that. You know, and I wouldn't blame Lloyd Pierce if he's sitting at home saying to himself, "Man, if I'd had my whole roster to work with too, you know, I could have done that." You know, just from some of the reporting that came out after he was let go, I'm not totally convinced of that. And, you know, shout out to Nate McMillan just from the sense, you know, I wrote a short story about the Hawks earlier this year, and it was right around the time they made the move to let go of Pierce, and was kind of saying just how big a second half of the season this was going to be for the Hawks, for everybody, theoretically for Travis Schlenk, you know, for the idea of how, you know, if this doesn't work, how on earth do we build around Trae Young? We just committed all this money for all these guys. Do we need to maybe move some of them if we don't make the playoffs since this didn't work? You know, and just, you know, what does the future look like for Trae Young when he's obviously a star, but like if he, you know, if he can't win with guys around him for whatever reason, what does that mean for this particular rebuild and whether you have to tear it all down around him? And, you know, I don't think they would have ever entertained trade talks for him or anything, but if they're not winning and he's just there and he's shiny and they're not winning, like what good does it have to, you know, for him to be there? What good is it for him to be there? So all that said, you know, I was really curious to see what Nate McMillan would do. I've been a fan of his for a long time. I know he's had the playoff failures with Indiana, but I was also stunned when Indiana let him go. I've written this before, tweeted about it before. The 4 years he was in Indiana, when I was at 538, and still they have this at 538, they have a projection model that, you know, that you referenced earlier about the, you know, that does playoff odds, but also before the season projects what, you know, in the preseason projects a record for each team based on how much talent they have and how many minutes guys are going to play. And Nate McMillan, for 4 years in a row, each season, the Pacers squeezed at least five more wins than they were projected to have before the season, each of his 4 years there. So I think for the 4 years he was there, they finished something like a plus 32 in wins, every one of those years having at least a plus five in front of it.
Wild.
And the crazy thing is that he probably has continued that streak this year, even while only coaching for half the season. I'm sure he squeezed at least five more wins than, you know, any model would have projected the Hawks to have at the All-Star break. So I, you know, I can't say enough about him, you know, whether I would have him winning, I'm not completely sure, because a lot of it did seem like it was, you know, having good health. But man, like, I think very easily he could have been in the top three. And then, you know, kind of piggybacking off that with the Hawks for a second, you referenced this too. I think very easily you could have had Clint Capella in as a defensive player of the year candidate in the top three. Was a little bit surprised to see Draymond there. I don't have a huge problem with it, because I think he should be first team all defense anyway. But I probably would have had either Capella or Adebayo in that spot. Might even have leaned toward Capella. I'm not sure. I just think playing with that team that's okay on defense but not great, and certainly not that good when he's not there, I tend to lean more in that direction. So I, you know, I those were the two that stood out to me. The sixth man candidates were actually the same three that I had. I would probably put Rose over Clarkson. So, you know, I'm not sure if my vote will, or not that I'm voting, but if my ballot would look the same way as what's going to end up being the finish, I think Clarkson will probably still win. But yeah, that didn't shock me. That's what I would have had. I felt bad because I love Brunson. I wrote about him earlier in the year, probably would have been fourth on my list, but I didn't have too much of a problem with that. I didn't have a huge problem with anything. What about you?
You know, I agree with what you said there about defensive player of the year a little bit. Like, I would have had Bam Adebayo as a finalist. Okay. No disrespect to Ben Simmons. No disrespect to Draymond Green. Both great defenders. I just think that Bam, you just kind of look at the pieces that are around him and what he's accomplished and how they defend. And, like, he personifies Eric Spoelstra's imagination, if that makes any sense. Like, he's so just, like, they can blitz, they can switch, and he switches a lot onto everybody. He can guard in the post. Like, he's like, if I was thinking of what is a perfect defender, I would think about Bam Adebayo. So that was a little bit of a bummer. And longtime listeners of this show will know that, you know, most improved player, I just, if you're in your second season,
me too. Yep.
You just, what are we doing here? Like,
yeah. Especially with a guy that, like, that wasn't healthy enough to play originally.
Exactly.
And, like, we still don't know what, I mean, it's just really weird. I thought that was weird. So I wouldn't have even had him on my ballot. I know you're talking about Michael Porter Jr.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I was about to say something completely ridiculous. I was about to say I would sooner put him on my all NBA ballot than I would put him on my most improved ballot, just because we didn't have a frame of reference for what improvement from him. Now, I will say this. I mean, it's silly on the one hand, but it's not. I can't remember anybody improving as much defensively in one season, in one year, than Michael Porter Jr. But again, if you were right, like, who was writing him off completely last year, say he'll never be a good defender or never be a great player? Like, we didn't know. And quite frankly, we weren't in a position to know, because think about all the guys that the Nuggets had as of a year ago that were kind of crowding and clogging that space for, I mean, how old is Michael Porter? 20, 21? Is he 21 yet? Like, so I'm with you on that. I literally had that down. I was like, oh shoot, I forgot it was on my list. I wouldn't have even had him on my ballot, just because I don't think second year. I don't even know if third year guys should be on the ballot for most improved. I mean, we could put rookies on the ballot if we want to. You give it to Kobe White or you give it to Anthony Edwards if you want to, you know, from first half to second half. But I just don't see the point with guys that young and that new to the league, particularly in an offseason where for really young players, they didn't even have a real offseason to work. So I just didn't understand the point of that. But, you know, to each his own, the league doesn't really define what these things are, which is why it's even more puzzling that, you know, the idea of letting you vote two centers onto the All-NBA team, like all of a sudden for them to be putting parameters on what you can and can't do, it's very weird to me.
No, you're bringing stuff up that's going to get us into another 2 hours of conversation. Yeah. So all that stuff really irritates me. I would have had Jaylen Brown personally in Michael Porter Jr.'s spot. That's like a young vet, quote unquote, who made noticeable leaps in parts of his game that were weaknesses. I think that's what this award should reward, frankly. And right before we go, I just wanted to quickly shout out Anthony Edwards, who you just mentioned. You know, I don't think he's going to win Rookie of the Year, but one of the most wild stats to me is that he played in all 72 games this season. Like, that is remarkable. And given everything that has happened, particularly to that organization this year, from a mental health perspective, from, you know, just a lot of losing, and the fact that he's a rookie and there was no summer league and there was no prolonged training camp, and he improved as the year went on, as you pointed out. So I just wanted to shout him out. He's incredible. Love him. Anything else to say, Chris?
No, not at all. I'm spot on with you there. I've been kind of amazed at the second half he's had. And it's interesting because, you know, in the same wavelength as what I just said about about Michael Porter, you know, last year, where it might have been difficult to kind of see exactly what was there because Murray's there and you've got obviously Millsap in a slightly different role, and you've got you've got Jeremy Grant there, you know, playing kind of a fourth role. Porter wasn't going to get every opportunity to shine there offensively, or just kind of the green light that he has now. The guy wasn't even playing, you know, for the first part of last season. He wasn't even, you know, regularly in the rotation, regularly getting to play. So of course someone's going to make statistical improvements. Of course someone's going to make improvements generally, just because they're getting to play. And he was already really talented. And quite frankly, a lot of us knew that he was really talented. We're kind of shaking our heads as to why Malone wasn't getting him in more games to begin with. So I'm right there with you on that. But Edwards, from that standpoint, he has guys that, as talented as they are, you know, I've tweeted about this, kind of can keep the ball out of his hands, maybe not intentionally, but just as guys that are used to kind of running the show. Sometimes that's Cat, sometimes it's D'Angelo Russell. And even in that game where he dropped 42 or whatever it was, I watched the last six or seven possessions of that game, like him not touch the ball, even though he's 8 of 9 from three and 42 points. But he was regularly, you know, 25, 30 points a game, not a game, but, you know, 25, 30 point performances in that second half, on efficient shooting. You know, if we're going to, you know, make tweets and kind of say, well, we're paying too much attention to that dunk. I mean, he regularly was kind of bringing it and just looked like a completely different player. But again, in a year where there was no summer league, in a year where there was no real training camp, in a year where your roster was out and dealing with COVID, maybe more harshly than anyone else did, just in light of what Cat went through and is still going through, I'm sure. It was amazing to watch what he did in the second half, and really encouraging to where, you know, he does that again next year and it makes some improvement. We're going to be having questions about whether you've got two franchise players there, as opposed to just the one, and what that looks like and what it changes about kind of the way we look at them. They've got a huge offseason coming up.
Well, Chris, we made it to the end of our first episode together. This was so much fun. Next week, we will break down why Janice Soprano is the best Sopranos character. I cannot wait.
No, we will not. or if we do, I promise you that we might as well be around not around the horn. What's the name of the show? It might as well be you and me debating on like First Take or something, because there's no way I'm going to agree with you on that ever.
Incredible.
Ever.
Incredible, incredible. Beautiful. So, you know, I want to thank the Open Floor Globe for listening in. Please email the show with any and every question you guys can possibly think of. We didn't get a chance to fold any questions into today's episode, but we'll definitely be doing that throughout the postseason. So hit us up at openfloormail@gmail.com. That's openfloormail@gmail.com. Until next time, everyone stay safe, enjoy your weekend, and have fun watching the NBA playoffs. Whoa. Yeah. What? Whoa. Ha ha ha. Yeah. Ha.